the 50 plus age bracket, that means you have experiences, skills, stories to tell. We want to help you tell those stories.
Ever consider becoming a podcaster? It's easier than you think, and it's a great way to share your experiences with others.
To learn more, contact your local campus and community radio station.
Or visit podcastingforseniors.ca.
Oh, everyone's got stories to tell.
Hi, I'm Rebecca.
And I'm Megan.
Together we are Lark and Poe.
You're listening to CFRC 101.9 in Kingston, Ontario.
G'day and welcome to a Grad Chat, your opportunity to find out about graduate research here at Queen's. My name is CJ the DJ and I am your host for this week's Grad Chat. Of course, a show like this could not happen without the support of the School of Graduate Studies and Postdoctoral Affairs, as well as CFRC. So thank you very much to both of them. Now, if your mates miss the show at any time, you can download the podcast the next day on either iTunes, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and CFRC Podcast. So no excuse not to hear what our awesome students and postdoctoral fellows are doing. Today, I would like to introduce you to Gabby Toretto, who has just completed her Master's in Pathology and Molecular Medicine under the supervision of Dr. Scott Davey and Dr. Harriet Furlotta. Welcome to Grad Chat, Gabby, and congratulations.
Awesome. Thank you very much for having me.
How does it feel knowing you've done?
It feels like a weight has been lifted off. I'm feeling pretty good, but also I'm staying here at Queen's for another year as well, so have some familiarity in the coming year too.
Well, that's great. I mean, I hate it when, well, I don't really hate it, but, you know, there are times that not everyone wants to stick around. Once they're done, they're gone, which is really quite sad because I miss seeing our students around the place mm-hmm. and learning where they are in their research. So I'm glad you were able to sort of stick around. So with that then, why are you sticking around? What are you doing?
Very good question. So yes, I just finished my master's in November of 2024, and I'm staying as a research associate for another year with my lab, the same lab that I completed my master's work with, finishing off some loose ends that we had for my master's work, as well as trying out some new things, just like Grad Chat today.
That's perfect. Well, it must be hard, particularly in master's. You start a project and you don't always get to finish it, as you said.
Exactly.
Because you're only here for 2 years, and we all know research isn't always that quick.
Exactly. You go into it thinking that you're going to be doing one thing, and at least in my experience, I found that my project was constantly changing every day almost. So it's a very cool experience getting to immerse yourself in a field and figuring out that there are so many branching problems, branching questions that come out of those original research questions.
Well, I guess too, I mean, and we'll get into your project shortly, but I guess your project, was it started by someone else and you then took it over? Well, it's part of Dr. Davey's lab, of course, but I'm sure there's lots of things going on in that lab which mm-hmm. gets started by one student and then is taken over. Did that kind of happen for you?
Very similarly, actually. We had a summer student who was working throughout the summer before I started my master's, who found some interesting trends in terms of BRCA1, the gene, and variants within the gene as well. And we used that idea and we used that trend to develop my master's project. Myself, as well as a master's student, have now been working on this project into our master's.
That's brilliant. And as probably people are probably saying, what's BRCA1? And we will get to that because it's going to be more clear mm-hmm. shortly. One more question before we do a bit more background. Why did you get into research in the first place? Did you do some in undergrad? Because some undergrad programs have a research component which gives you an inkling of what to expect, but not everyone then continues. Mm-hmm. Why did you want to?
Very good question. There's multiple factors that sort of led me to where I am today. Firstly, being I've always been interested in cancer research, given that I have a personal history with cancer through family,
right.
As anyone can relate to, I believe everyone has some sort of connection to cancer, be it through themselves or through family members. So I've always had that interest in learning more about what cancer is and the mechanisms behind it and what we can do as individuals to help progress the field.
Right.
So having also completed my undergrad here in life sciences at Queen's, I've been exposed to many different types of fields, including cancer. I remember I took a Cancer 380 course in my third year.
Oh, great.
And that exposed me to the mechanisms of cancer, the origins of cancer, the genetic aspect of cancer as well, which I thought was really cool. And in terms of research experience, I completed my 499 or my fourth year research project.
Right, right.
Under the supervision of Dr. Harriet Feilotter, who is now my supervisor in my master's program. And in that project, I looked on something a little bit different, but something related to what I did in my master's work. But we were looking at different mutations in tumors from lung cancer samples. So
right.
That's sort of what exposed me to the genetic aspect of cancer and what inspired me to continue on into a master's degree.
Well, I think we're so lucky here because we have the cancer research trials here, you know, the Sinclair Cancer Research Institute.
Exactly, yes.
And for a university that's only medium size, we're really hitting above what we should be. And we have this great work that we do. And of course, people like yourself in pathology and molecular medicine, as well as biomedical molecular sciences, et cetera. It's just fascinating what we can offer here at Queen's.
Thank you.
Both for the community at large, but as well as our students getting an opportunity to be a part of this. And we all know that, you know, a lot of us, as you said, know people who have had various forms of cancer. Of course, there's lots of them, unfortunately. And not all of them are shown the same way, which is why we need a lot of research. But you're looking more about, well, let me give everyone your research topic, and then we'll sort of, if you can give some background a little bit as well, would
For
be
sure.
helpful. Now, I could give the proper title, which I'm going to tell people anyway. Assessing the clinical significance of BRCA1 BRCT domain variants of uncertain significance, in brackets VUS, end of bracket, or, thank you very much for coming back with another one, assessing BRCA1 genetic variants involved in hereditary breast and ovarian cancer.
Still a mouthful, but
it's still a mouthful.
That was a little bit more digestible.
But at least you got the word cancer in there and hereditary and things. Because this is one of the things I always laugh about, particularly people in some of the STEM disciplines, some of the terminology. Who knows what that acronym is? But I know you're going to explain it to me. But that's the beauty, right? So changing how we do that. So why choose, I mean, maybe you didn't choose it, maybe it was Dr. Dave who chose it, but why choose looking at things like hereditary breast and ovarian cancer? Because I would imagine both of them are very different, aren't they?
So yes, they are completely different diseases. However, the reason why we're looking at them together is because in terms of hereditary cases of breast and ovarian cancer, the most common cause of these cases are germline or inherited variants or mutations in BRCA1 and 2 genes.
So they're just genes, they're not a protein or something? Because I hear all these other words, you know, proteins and this and that.
It can be confusing at times to decipher, yes.
Right.
But BRCA1, it actually stands for breast cancer gene 1. So that's why called BRCA1, that the connection it has with breast and ovarian cancer. But yes, BRCA1 and 2 are genes. However, they code for proteins. And what these proteins do, the reason why BRCA1 and 2 are called tumor suppressor genes is because the proteins that they encode, they protect our genome. They serve as methods of preserving our genomic integrity through methods such as DNA repair. So it's very important that these genes are functional. And when we see that these genes are no longer functional in some people, they lead to significantly elevated risks of developing breast and ovarian cancer.
Well, that's a bit depressing, isn't it? It's usually the case, though, isn't it? Something that's there for good, if it doesn't work properly, we're in trouble.
It can feel depressing at times. However, it does open up avenues for different targeted treatments or surveillance and things like that as well.
So with that, then, what is the prevalence of this? Of this, I guess, is it the prevalence of breast and ovarian cancer, or is it the prevalence of this particular gene getting blocked or not functioning properly?
Oh, good question. Yes. Yeah. So I can start off with a general picture of breast and ovarian cancer. So breast cancer is the most common cancer in Canadian women. Approximately 1 in 8 women will be diagnosed with breast cancer in her lifetime, which is a very scary
that
statistic.
That is scary for us women, yes.
Ovarian cancer, alternatively, is not as common as breast cancer. I believe it's the ninth most common cancer in Canadian women, although it is 3 times as lethal, mostly attributed to its later stage of diagnosis.
Right, right.
So the majority of breast and ovarian cancer cases, they're considered sporadic. However, a fraction of these, approximately 5 to 10% of breast and 20 to 25% of ovarian cancer cases are linked to inherited mutations in cancer susceptibility genes, the majority of which being BRCA1 and 2.
Right. Well, it's interesting too, because a little bit of personal thing here, because we've had breast cancer in our family, my GP gets me tested once a year.
Absolutely.
Now, if I didn't have that in family history, it may only be every 2 years. So,
well, thank you for sharing that.
Yeah, so it's one of those things, I guess, that if you got it, you may be more susceptible without even knowing it.
Right. Given the link between BRCA1 and 2 mutations and the elevated risk of developing breast and ovarian cancer, that's what's led to the implementation of genetic testing, as you said, to identify carriers of these pathogenic BRCA1 and 2 variants. So in Ontario, I believe we have provincial guidelines that outlines eligibility requirements for women to obtain this sort of testing, such as a family history of breast or ovarian cancer, or having a known BRCA1 variant in the family, or even being of a certain descent, such as Ashkenazi Jewish women are at an elevated risk of developing breast and ovarian cancer with BRCA1 mutations.
So this isn't a normal going to have a mammogram. This is a different test altogether, because I think, you know, if you're having a mammogram, how can you get down to the nitty-gritty here? Because the mammogram is just showing you a possibility.
Right, right. This is a different type of test. So it's sort of clinical genetic sequencing. So we're sequencing, in this case, the BRCA1 gene, and we're scanning for alterations within this gene that could be benign, which means like they're not cancer causing, or they could be pathogenic, which means that they have deleterious effects on BRCA1 and 2.
Right. So is this the Angelina Jolie thing when she knew she had hereditary genes, or potentially she went and had another test and said she had the possibility? Is this what we're talking about here?
I'm glad that you brought that up, actually. Yes, the Angelina Jolie effect is what I believe you're referring to.
Yes.
And yes, so she had a pathogenic BRCA1 mutation, and because of this, she took different steps to reduce her risk of developing breast and ovarian cancer. So what I believe she did is that she had a double mastectomy, as well as other prophylactic treatments to reduce her risk. And that's another reason why genetic testing has become so much more prevalent in women, is because women going into testing, if they have a positive test, meaning that they have a genetic variant that is pathogenic in BRCA1, they have the ability to take these management steps to reduce their risk, be it through enhanced surveillance, risk reduction strategies such as mastectomies, chemo preventative treatments as well. And for women who also have breast or ovarian cancer already, knowing that they have a specific mutation within BRCA1, it makes them eligible for different types of targeted therapies that have shown to be more effective for women with BRCA1 or 2 mutated tumors.
But is this kind of test, sorry, you may not know this, just the way my brain is working. So is this kind of test easy for women to go and have, cheap, easy to get in, or is it only for those people who can afford it? And I mean, we don't want to tell everyone should go and have this test. So, you know, how do we find that balance?
Good question.
Between just having a mammogram, which I'm glad more women are having now, to going that next step of saying, well, it's been in my family, maybe I've got this gene, maybe I should go and get that tested too.
Right. So genetic testing has become more accessible in recent years, and that can be attributed to the development of next generation sequencing. So this is a sequencing technique that is a lot more affordable, that's a lot quicker, that opens a lot of doors for sort of precision medicine, in which we are able to pinpoint mutations within genes that can be targeted for cancer therapies or for surveillance methods.
Right.
So in terms of genetic testing, it has become more accessible in that way, and that has enhanced precision medicine in that way as well. However, with the increase in genetic testing, it's also resulted in a lot more of these discoveries of variants of uncertain significance, which is
great for you guys, because you go, yes, I can go and check that out as well. So let's just remind ourselves then of the function of this BRCA1 gene. So can you explain again what the function is of this?
Right. So BRCA1 is a pleiotropic or multifunctional gene that is involved in various methods of preserving genomic stability, primarily through a DNA repair process called homologous recombination.
Okay.
So BRCA1 is involved in a series of complex pathways that ensure that DNA is being repaired properly. Yes.
Which is important, right?
So, very important.
So if that doesn't happen, that's when we get more mutations.
And that's what would lead to cancer.
Which should lead to cancer. Loving it. So far, I'm following, which is good.
Perfect.
Don't always, but I am. So thank you. And so tell us about what part are you playing in looking at this particular gene? What are you trying to do? Find out when it mutates or doesn't function properly, or finding out how it performs its function?
Right. So the problem that we're looking specifically at is variants of uncertain significance in BRCA1. So in a situation where a woman goes in for genetic testing, if she receives a VUS in her genetic test, meaning that there's a variant in BRCA1, or a mutation, I should say, that has an uncertain effect on gene function and disease risk, this leads to a lot of ambiguity in the results. And it's a very critical clinical problem, as clinicians are unable to effectively interpret these genetic testing results. Subsequently, it results in their inability to provide appropriate management steps to these women. And obviously, this is a very distressing situation for women who don't know their level of risk for developing breast or ovarian cancer.
So a mutation doesn't necessarily mean it's going to lead to cancer.
Exactly,
yes. So, which is why it's difficult for the physician to figure out, is it going to have a problem or not? Is that what you're saying?
So there's different types of mutations that can occur in any gene, including BRCA1. Some mutations, they're very minor. They may not affect the overall function of the protein that they translate. But there are other mutations that are much more significant that can greatly impact the functionality of BRCA1.
Right.
However, there are variants that are in that sort of gray region where we're not sure. Maybe it could affect it, maybe it couldn't. So that it's sort of that the range of a variant. It could be very benign or it could be pathogenic, but there's a gray region inside where we're not too sure of the effect that it has. And especially with BRCA1 being a multifunctional gene, which has many different roles, it becomes increasingly difficult to determine, yes, this one variant, one amino acid switch can actually cause an impactful change in its functionality.
So how are you finding this out, though? Is it a machine? Is it an algorithm? How are you trying to determine if there's an issue, where it is, and what it's doing?
Right. So a database that was very helpful for us, it's called ClinVar. So it's a variant classification database that has all pathogenic and benign variants across genes, including BRCA1, but a multitude of other human genes as well. This database also has a compilation of uncertain variants or VUSs in these genes as well. So we can see the distribution of benign variants, of pathogenic variants, and of VUSs as well. And there's a large spike in VUSs now, especially with the implementation of increasing genetic testing. So we can see where these variants are, but my master's work was dedicated to looking at different ways that we can actually assess these variants and determine their pathogenicity, both through computational methods as well as functional lab methods.
Ooh, computational.
Makes me shiver too.
Do you like math or you don't? Unfortunately, it is there, but luckily someone else usually does the algorithm for you. Yes. So we've clearly got a big database. Is that housed here in Kingston, or is it a Canadian database?
I believe it's an international database
where
different clinicians, different clinical labs can contribute to the database with findings of the pathogenicity of different variants that they're studying. So we're hoping to contribute to that database as well with the findings that we've found through my master's, as well as the additional work that we've been doing in our lab.
So if you can contribute whatever you find, what are you hoping to achieve other than to add more data to this database?
Right. So the overall goal of my research project, as well as our lab, is to enhance genetic testing for women. So if we contribute to this database, say that we are able to concretely identify a pathogenic variant that used to be identified as a VUS, clinicians are now able to effectively determine whether a woman is actually at an increased risk of developing breast or ovarian cancer if that woman has that variant in their BRCA1 gene. So hopefully through this research, we can better elucidate the impact that these variants have on gene function or BRCA1 gene functionality in order to enhance genetic testing for women and provide them with more clear steps in order to reduce their risk or improve their treatments.
Improving treatments is clearly what we want to get to, but even knowing that they may have this one little variant, we all know everyone behaves differently. So how do you or the physicians take into account all other variables? Because when you're looking at a treatment, you've got to take in all the variables around you, and one treatment doesn't fit everybody.
Exactly, yes.
So how do they get around that, just from learning that they've got this one little one?
Mm-hmm. So in previous years, it used to be a cookie cutter sort of situation for cancer treatments, in which every cancer patient would have the same sort of treatments. However, in recent years, the field of medicine has moved towards precision medicine in a way that each patient is treated as an individual, in which they have their own sort of fingerprint of what their cancer looks like, be it right. through specific mutations in a gene or in multiple genes. And this dictates how treatment can then be applied, because there are different sorts of targeted therapeutics, such as I mentioned maybe earlier about PARP inhibitors. PARP inhibitors work by targeting BRCA1 mutated tumor cells. So this sort of targeted therapy can be highly effective for women who already have a BRCA1 mutated tumor. So it enables for a diversification of the different types of therapies that can be given to patients, instead of that sort of one size fits all therapy.
Can you also look, my head is going everywhere. Can you also look, I mean, you might find this variant, as we said, it doesn't necessarily mean it's going to cause cancer. But if we find this variant in one person, can we then, the treatment be more of a preventative treatment to stop that mutating to a point where it does become cancer? Or am I totally missing the point there?
That's an interesting question. I'm going to have to think about that a little bit. The way that cancer develops in BRCA1 mutated people is that everyone inherits two copies of the BRCA1 gene, along with every other gene that they have.
Right.
When they inherit a mutated copy, that's no longer functional, they still have one copy that is functional.
Oh, well, that's
so
good.
They are still able to protect their DNA, perhaps not to the same extent that they would with two copies. However, they're still functioning. They're cancer-free because of this functional copy. However, as one ages, if this other functional copy of BRCA1 is no longer functional, that's what leads to cancer. So I'm not too sure in terms of preventative treatments with VUS. However, it does help with sort of the surveillance and ensuring that we catch cancer as early as possible in these people who have an elevated risk.
So you do pick up the fact that one might still be okay?
Yes.
Okay, well, that's great. That's great. Tick. Yeah, because it'd be nothing. I mean, I guess it's like, you know, someone's kidney, one kidney fails, you've still got another one that you can use. So it's good that there's always a backup in our systems.
Absolutely.
So you're still helping this project?
I am, yes.
Okay. What part did you get up to? So for you now to want to be able to finish it off.
Sure. Yeah, I can give a little synopsis of the work that I was doing. So my master's project was really cool, such that it had two components to it. It had that scary computational side of it, as well as the functional side of it. So the computational side was, we had the vision that a computational tool that was tailored not only towards a specific gene, but towards a specific domain of a gene would proved to be highly effective in accurately predicting a variant within that gene as pathogenic or benign.
Oh, okay.
So what we did was we collected different in silico tools, which are different types of machine learning algorithms that measure different aspects of sequence variation, be it evolutionary conservation of a variant or biochemical impact of it. And so we collected all those together. We applied those tools to all known pathogenic and benign variants within BRCA1, BRCT domain.
Okay.
Once we had those scores, then we used a feature selection program. It's called Molecular Feast, which was actually developed here at Queen's by Dr. Trishkin, as well as the Renwick Lab. But what this program does is that it ranks tools by its discriminatory ability on two separate groups. So for our case, it identified the in silico tools that best discriminated between pathogenic and benign variants. So we basically found the most accurate tools among the ones that we identified. And from there, we were able to build a computational classifier with these best tools that was able to predict the pathogenicity of VUSs within this BRCA1 gene, which is very cool.
Wow. That was a lot that you learned in two short years.
I hope that made sense as well.
I find it fascinating how much you can accomplish in such a short time. Now, I know it helps that you've got these databases that can help you. So you're not actually having to collect samples. I call them samples yourself.
A quote that I like is like, we're standing on the shoulders of giants. Like, I couldn't have done it without the support of the faculty here at Queen's, my professors and students as well. It's a very amazing environment to be in, especially with the Cancer Research Department here at Queen's as well. It's a very cool.
Particularly, you're looking at one little section, and there's so much more around it.
Right, absolutely.
So much more around that could go wrong, unfortunately. No, that's fascinating, and I think it's lovely that you've been able to stay on for another year.
Right. And so with this additional year, we're investigating some of the VUSs that we predicted as pathogenic or benign from our computational classifier as a basic test to see, is our classifier actually accurate in predicting a pathogenic or benign variant? So what these lab experiments are doing is we're basically measuring the impact that these variants have on BRCT normal ability. And what BRCT does is that it binds with different proteins that are involved in homologous recombination or DNA repair. So by actually investigating the impact that these variants have on BRCT's binding ability, we can then deduce if this variant is deleterious or not. And what we're seeing from our results right now is that they're aligning with the computational predictions, which
is
great to see.
Well, that's nice to see, isn't it? There'd be nothing where you say, oh my God, we did all that wrong.
Definitely a sigh of
relief. What did we miss? Because it only takes one little thing, doesn't it, to sort of throw any sort of result off, or potential result, or some other variable that we hadn't considered.
For sure. With such a changing field as well, you always have to consider all the changing variables.
And I guess down the track, one of the things, whether it's this kind of lab or another lab or together, is, you know, once you find this, you know, why is it changing? Now, what's made one of these little two die off and not do its function, etc.? But not necessarily just within our body. You know, we all know environment can have an impact. I mean, this one is hereditary. I understand that. But you can have a hereditary gene, but then the impact from outside can also have an effect on it, whether make it worse if you've got the gene or not worse, kind of thing. But either way. So there's a lot of variables you've always got to take into consideration, because no one's constant.
Cancer, its nature is, it's very multifactorial. There's many factors that go into it, both genetic as well as environmental, as you mentioned as well. So every cancer patient has a different sort of landscape in terms of how their cancer develops. And that leads to how their treatment should be and how they should be reacting to different types of treatments.
Food for thought. Okay, well, that was awesome. So before we go, I do want to ask you a couple of things about what else you do.
Sure.
Because I know grad students are always very, very busy, but somehow they manage to find times to do other things. Like, I mean, I'm looking here, you volunteer with the pediatric unit at KGH.
I do,
yes. That's pretty neat. What made you want to do that?
Thank you very much. It's one of the most rewarding experiences that I've had here at Queen's and at Kingston. But I started this position about 1 or 2 years ago now. It started off as a one-time volunteer thing with the holiday events for the kids at KGH. And then it translated into a volunteer position that I enjoy going to every week. But it's basically visiting the floor and getting to play with kids as well. And it's so amazing to see just their resilience and being able to provide them with a little outlet as well outside of their treatment. It's something that I find is super rewarding and I love doing.
Well, I'm sure they love having you around. I mean, it always breaks my heart when I see kids in hospital. They should be out playing with their mates.
Me as well.
And having fun. So I'm sure they really appreciate you coming along each week. And then other things, like everyone's getting into this bouldering rock climbing thing. I must be the only person in Kingston or at Queens that doesn't do it these days.
It's weird if you meet someone who hasn't gone. Yes.
So what got you into that?
I actually started about 1 or 2 years ago now too. It started off as a one-time thing with a housemate, and it's turned into quite a passion for me as well. I think it's, you know, the mix of having some sort of physical activity as well as some sort of problem solving of climbing up that wall.
That's a good.
A
I love
adrenaline.
Puzzles.
Oh, exactly.
So I love puzzles. I always wonder whether I'd have the strength or the flexibility to get my leg up to the next point.
It's like a physical puzzle almost. Yes.
Physical might not work for me, but one day I will try it. And clay sculpting. So you're a bit of an artist.
try to be. It started off as I was at Michael's for something completely irrelevant, and they were having a sale on a 10-pound block of clay, and I thought, you know what, my grade eight my grade eight training of clay making can really come in handy here. So I've just been sort of doing a self-taught little clay making, and
that's brilliant.
Have some clay making nights with friends too. It's a lot of fun and very therapeutic.
Well, there you go. We all need a bit of therapy every now and then. Gabby, it has been great chatting you. I do appreciate you coming on.
But thank you very much for having me.
Oh, no worries at all. So that's it, everyone. Another week of Grad Chat sadly comes to an end. Don't forget you can download the show tomorrow from either iTunes, Google Podcasts, Spotify and CFRC Podcast. Just type in a Grad Chat. Until next week, this is CJ the DJ signing off with a big hooray.
Did you know that alcohol is a leading risk factor for disease, disability, and premature death in Canada? Did you know tips and tricks to limit alcohol use, especially during adult social gatherings? The province of Ontario recommends adults who use alcohol to drink slowly and consume lots of water, to eat before and while they are drinking, and to choose alcohol-free beverages and activities. Learn more about your health and the safe use of alcohol by visiting publichealthontario.ca.
Sunny la.
Quay.
Why eat beet snack seal?
Tan she.
Tanet e. Negar dakote.
This is Words and Culture, a series on Indigenous languages, funded by SiriusXM through the Community Radio Fund of Canada.
I, the language. The language is everything. It's the culture, it's our ceremony, it's our song, it's our dance. It's going to our old village sites and getting in touch with our ancestors. It's getting in touch with the land. Once you have a relationship with the land, that's your spirituality and no one can take it away. So if you build a strong foundation with the land, you've got something special. I see that in my grandsons. My granddaughters and my grandsons have a relationship with the land. And it's great to see. So I'm very hopeful now, today, when I see my grandchildren and the interest in the language that's happening. I think people realize how important it is and how fragile it is right now. In Skitigut, I think there's less than 20 fluent speakers. 20, if that, maybe less. I'm not sure if, I can't say for the numbers in Kau Masset. But I know their numbers are pretty low too.
Sankila. Good day. I'm Chrissy Lane Sinclair, your host for the Haida episodes. I am a Haida Cree musician and storyteller, and I am going to bring you along a journey to my Haida homeland. The first time I came to Masset since I was a kid, I think I was in Vancouver at a wedding and I saw my Auntie Ina, and she was like, you have to come home and learn what it means to be Haida. And when an auntie tells you something, you do it. So I went home that summer and I went for a walk. She lives right on the beach, like most beautiful sunset you've ever seen. And so I went for a walk and I see this, like, there's all these totem poles. And I was just like, it was so, so beautiful. And I thought it was a museum. So I like went to go in, and then there's this guy sitting there carving a totem pole. And I was like, how do I get into the museum? And he said, it's my house. And it was Jimmy Hart's house. And if you don't know who Jimmy Hart is, he's like the best carver ever. Assisted Bill Reed. Just like the guy. He's the guy. Anyway, he's like, anyway, sit down. And I just sat and talked with him for like an hour, and he told me about the poles and told me he knew my mom was like in the same grade as her. And yeah, that was kind of where I learned, is just like, you just go and you hang out and learn and listen. Anyway, let's move on. In the last episode, we visited brothers Jolin and Gwai Edenshaw, who are master carvers. They created a totem pole dedicated to their father, Chief Gidansta, also widely known as Gujau. But carving and raising the pole is only part of the journey. There are many moving parts and knowledge to be had, if you're listening and if you can ask the right questions.
So how long has it been in the making from the catalyst in your mind to now?
Well, I probably started thinking about this about 2 years ago while we're working on the memorial pole for Gathlai. That's when our dad decided to get us to do a pole for him. Figured it was time to do another feast.
Yeah, so with this one, we did, you know, a lot of back and forth with our dad. But like one of the things that he wanted to do was showcase some of his crests, and we did mortuary style memorial pole for Uncle Percy when he passed, and that had the grizzly bear and the mountain goat. So on this, he wanted, you know, other crests rather than that, because we were talking about doing a grizzly bear on here. But we did a sea grizzly to sort of showcase a different crest.
Our starting point for the sea grizzly was one of his learning pieces. So a pole that he had carved of a sea grizzly. Well, when we were little kids, he carved it in the boat shed over a few years. Something that kind of arose somewhat organically over the process of designing and doing this pole is that the original artist that he based his sea grizzly on was actually a Gdansta. So Gdansta is his chief's name, but it was a Gdansta, I think, six generations ago.
Well, 1850s anyway.
Yeah.
The day before the pole raising, I joined the brothers to chat about the process and why the pole is being raised at Coggeel's Kikwai.
So this is an old village site, Coggeel's, and I never knew too much about the site before this project. So the Skidans people, another name is Coggeel's Kikwai, which means those born at Coggeel's. So even though their village is away from here, how it works is you follow your mom's side. So a lot of the Skidans ladies would be married into this village. And so their children would be born here and then end up going back to Skidans later as they grew up. So the Skidans people have a big connection to this village. And sort of, you know, I think definitely a goal of mine, and I think, you know, all of us as carvers enjoy putting the poles, you know, sort of back out in the old village sites and around in different areas, as opposed to, you know, it's always amazing to put one up in your own village too, but, you know, it's this whole island is ours, right? So it's good to put them everywhere. It's taken over a year of carving. We had the tree on our first project that we worked together on, which was the pole that went to Jasper. We actually got the log originally for that, so it was something that we sort of started on together and had. That project was a collaboration, and then because it wasn't going in the ground, there's bark seams in the base, and the one in Jasper was going on a big hinge, so we couldn't use this one. So it sort of sat since then, and it sort of
15 years or so.
So our department really is the carving, and it's the Skidans people putting on the potlatch, and that's when the business will happen. So the pole itself is like a marker commemoration of what's the business of the potlatch.
Yeah, that's a good distinction to make. So the potlatch is not a celebration of the raising of the pole, but rather the pole serves to remind people into the future of what happened at the potlatch.
But before we get to business, there is a pole to be raised. Diane Brown says a prayer, and Jolin begins to do the carving dance, emulating what it looks like carving the pole. What you are hearing is Jolin breathing life into the pole. And then, the Gdansk pole is raised. Hundreds of people raise the pole with four giant lines of rope. And when it is level, the ground is filled with rocks. The sound of all of this is incredible.
Slow down on the back. Hold up.
Go back.
Yeah, Rodney and Ernie, tighten up a little.
Well, that was Chief Gdansk himself singing in front of the pole with the youth. Now there's a closed-door ceremony that, sorry guys, cannot be shared. But after, we'll all head to the hall for a feast and potlatch that we can share. While we're waiting to go to the potlatch, I'd like to share this song with you from another Haida musician, Carson Gray. Born of Haida and mixed descent, Carson Gray is an award-winning singer and songwriter who blends a piece of her surroundings on Haida Gwaii into a soulful sound, spiked with R&B energy, pop, and a twist of local spirit, which, if I may say, her spirit is dope. This is Salona.
Oh, Salona, is everything you are. I'm a shining star. Everything I am. The sky, ceiling. Whoa, whoa, whoa. One day, everyone gonna see that the sun above got a hold on me. What's L-O-V-E without you? And what am I without you too? Salana, it's everything you are. I'm a shining star. Everything I am. The sky, ceiling. Whoa, whoa, whoa. The future is as bright as we see. I'll get my rest at the cedar tree. Fields of dreams got a hold on me. When I hear a bird sing, it makes me think that love and light could be on the brink for us all. Salana, it's everything you are.
And that was Solana by Carson Gray. Now back to the business of the potlatch. We call it the business part because that is where all of the ceremonies, namings, etc. happens. Previously banned and all but eradicated, the art of creating and erecting totem poles has been practiced by the Haida forever. Different types of poles mark different things. A potlatch is place and time, and the pole is an event reminder, as I have newly learned on this trip. Different types of poles include clan crest poles, mortuary poles, or memorial poles. There are potlatch poles, and there are even shame poles. Now, I didn't know a lot about shame poles, so I did a little bit of research. Shame poles are carved to, I guess, embarrass people who've done something wrong. And they were really common in the 19th century, but they're still around. So a couple examples in Cordova, Alaska, a shame pole carved by Tlingit fisherman Mike Weber to protest Exxon Valdez oil spill. And in Ketchikan, the Seward shame pole commemorates the U.S. Secretary of Interior William Seward, who arranged the purchase of Alaska from Russia. So in essence, it's a protest. And that's cool. Sometimes these overlap and have different purposes, but they are similar in that they tell our history and clan story. After the pole is made for the occasion, the potlatch, which is sometimes a multi-day event, everything kicks into high gear after years of planning. This is where our business, our ceremony, and celebration happens. It's hard to put all of this into a nutshell, as there are many reasons for a pole and for a potlatch. For instance, a potlatch is also traditionally a demonstration of wealth, which is shown by gifting not only materials and food, but also skills. A potlatch is also where Haidas receive their Haida names. Mine is Nans Gon Kodju, the one who is the killer whale singer. After the pole raising and ceremony, I head to the hall in Skidigit, or Tlagilda, for the potlatch. Everything is underway and the Kluhanane singers are singing and dancing. It is standing room only, as the hall floor and the upper floor balcony are packed. Dance groups are invited from all over to potlatch and to share and to bear witness. From the audio, you can hear the regalia swoosh and the drums and the rattles in their hand. To actually describe it, I think Guai said it best.
It's an expression of slickness. So if something is pretty chuh, you can rest assured that it's pretty slick. Chuh, deadly is actually probably a perfect descriptor.
Huh, that's the word I'm looking for, and that doesn't exist in the English language. People were looking right. Huh. The words, the dancing, the history, and the opportunity to hear the elders speak. Huh. Food. Huh. The spoiler alert, the gifts are gonna be. Huh. Now that we've set the scene, let's go inside the hall where Terry Lynn Williams Davidson is sharing history.
We are what anthropologists call patrilocal, meaning that we lived in our father's town, but then we were raised by our uncles and our aunts, sometimes in another town. 1886 and 1887 was a period of dramatic population loss on the east coast of Paraguay. In 1888, the people remaining at Skidans and Anu left those villages and they formed a new village that included other southern Haida people at Nuklu, which is also called Arista Creek, or Church Creek. So we all amalgamated there before we came to Skidiot. At this point, there were only two southern villages outside of Skidiot, New Old Harbor, Kleina, and New Clue. The remaining members of all other villages had already moved to this town in Skidiot. In 1891, the Gold Harbor families, the Kleina families, moved to Skidiot, leaving only New Clue as the last hangout. And the people from the southern villages at New Clue moved to this village in 1897, including the Skidamsrians. Our history shows that we are a people of genealogy. We are related to each other, we are related to our land, and we recognize our ancestors in the land. We see evidence of this interrelationship in our clan names, like the Avails Pequawai. The name most people use today, Skidams, is actually the English pronunciation of our clan's chief, Gedamsta. Gedamsta means from his daughter. The high name for our village is Kona, and the town itself was called Kona Limnalai. We have also called our ancestral village of Skidams Huachi Ilnalai, or Huachi Lanas, Grizzly Bear Town, because the grizzly bear was a favorite crest of our clan. The Skidiot Inlet people called our clan the Shino Lanas, or the Kamshula Town people. This is likely because all Haida people lived the first part of our lives in the town that our father came from, as I said earlier, but later in life moved to our mother's village to learn from our clan members. For example, the boys moved to learn from their mother's brothers, and the girls moved to live with their Aulalam, their mother's sisters. Hazel Stevens, a very old and wise woman from this community, once told me that Susan Williams was truly a Shkinoljat. Susan Williams' father was from Kamshula, and therefore she was born there and raised there, as well as in Skidams. Later in life, she moved back to Skidams to be raised by her clan in Skidams. Her first husband was Chief Kamshula, again keeping the linkages between our clans. It has been said at the time of contact that Chief of Skidams was one of the most influential of all Haida chiefs. His importance was gained through the art of peace, not of war. This peacemaking was not only in Haida Gwaii, but through an exemption from war with the Tsimshian because of our close relationship with the chief of Lahlans, Kitkapna, Chabasa. Therefore, one of the responsibilities of all Skidam Ravens is to carry and develop the art of peacemaking. It is our understanding that our great-grandmother, Susan Williams, Gidapkotsle, whose name I carry, held the chieftainship of our clan when there was no longer a male member old enough.
I love peacemaking. And I love that that's a tradition. I've been thinking a lot about that since the Haida-Heltzik peace treaty. And since then, the relationship with Bella Bella, like, has grown so strong, you know? And you think about, like, colonization and what they tried to do and the fact that we're just, like, you know, so separated. So I think, like, bringing people together, it's, like, just stronger together. Anyway, Tarlin's amazing. So potlatches, they can last for days and days. Like, I think the longest one I went to was Bo Dick's potlatch in Alert Bay, and that was 3 days.
We come together, we sing, we dance, and then we feast.
Finishing in the early morning hours as the potlatch winds down, I'm kind of reflecting on past potlatches. In the beginning, there was so much to learn, but with every potlatch, I learn more. At Clu Hadane's canoe launch potlatch in the summer of 2024, I was asked to write their theme song. No pressure, right? I was so overwhelmed to joke with my cousin Candace Weir that she always had a way of making people rise to the occasion in the most terrifying way. I finished the songs about 5 minutes before the potlatch. I feel like ending on this note because I also feel like all of this does take a village, and I'm so proud to be Haida because it is so inclusive, and everyone has a role, and everyone is included, even if you're in a rock band. There is so much to learn and ways to grow if you just show up. The things that I bore witness to you, the conversations I had, and the wealth of knowledge that was passed on will never be forgotten. So happy, so So here's my song I wrote for Clue Haudenay's potlatch. How if you're listening?
Words and Culture is made possible with funding from SiriusXM through the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Words and Culture is produced by Kim Wheeler. Kaylin Belair is our audio engineer and editor.
Hausin Dang King Sam.
Maltus.
Ninuis Ahaha Miku Kwakwal.
Kachunautano.
Wapamatin Mina.
What's the like the taste of butter? A pretty dress. Wouldst thou like to live deliciously?
Join me, your host Chris, for The Witching Hour live on CFRC 101.9 FM every Wednesday at 12 a.m., where you can get your weekly dose of metalcore, post-hardcore, crying, screaming, and sometimes throwing up.
Oh my God!
Oh my God!
They say nothing good happens after midnight, but why not stay a while and find out?
Wouldn't it be cool if you could volunteer with Canada's oldest campus radio station? Well, sign up to volunteer with CFRC 101.9 FM today. We're always looking for new volunteers, and we offer a free training program, so no experience in radio production is necessary. You can start your own radio show or podcast, contribute to our news collective, help us sort through music sent to us by record labels and artists, help plan events, record PSAs for us, and even more. Reach out to our programming manager, Alex Fernandez, via email at programs@cfrc.ca for more information, or visit our website at cfrc.ca/volunteer and sign up today.
What's up? It's Pickles. Leave a message.
Let's have a kiki. Get ready for a fabulous time with dragshow.ca. From drag brunches to holiday cabarets, there's something for everyone. Check out the latest events and join in the fun. Visit dragshow.ca for all the details.
We are gonna serve
and work and turn
and honey.
Hey CFRC listeners. In celebration of International Women's Day, local icon Miss Emily and the Kingston Music Office are hosting an International Women's Day showcase on March 7th at the Broom Factory, with support from your friends here at CFRC. Experience a showcase celebrating the remarkable talents of women.